The talk is about how we think about spiritual maturity, enlightenment. And there's a difference between those two words, spiritual maturity and enlightenment. I'll unpack that a bit. So enlightenment is usually celebrated as kind of the ultimate reason to practice. And we're told not to cling to it, but we're also told that it's the highest freedom. And so it's kind of like, wait a second, what do I do there? How do I relate to that? And Suzuki Roshi said, if your effort is sincere, even if you don't quote make it, it's almost as good. Yeah. And I think, I don't know, there's a way that awakening is often imagined as something that kind of solves all of our problems. But it's more like, as far as I can tell, something that arises when we have no problems. Now, what on earth would it mean to have no problems? It does not mean eradicating the first noble truth that there is dukkha, that there's suffering, but it means that for a long time, maybe it's in the context of one's daily life, or maybe in the context often of intensive retreat, but for a long time, you no longer care so much about your life, and all you care about is awareness. This is makes for a life that doesn't feel plagued by problems. There's, of course, the flows of pleasure and pain, but there aren't problems. And maybe we even know certain moments of where the longing for freedom is so strong, the heart is so fatigued by the perennial deferring of happiness, and a different view comes into being. Yeah. So there are different maps of enlightenment, let's say something like different skills or different capacities that are emphasized. And different lineages have different models of all of this. And there's some value in decoding all of that, but there's some risk in decoding it too. So the risk is that it narrows our vision of what freedom is. It highlights some skills, but not others, some realizations, but not others. And, as I've done more and more, spent more and more time in Dharma world as I don't know, there's almost a certain kind of nostalgia for when I had less of a less fewer maps to understand spiritual experience, and there was just this kind of wonder and awe at discovering my mind and the signposts that are established by our tradition weren't there, and there was something actually freeing about not being burdened by a kind of map of what freedom was. Now, enlightenment, awakening, it's described in different ways. One description of like, oh, it's peace at every sense door. So at the eye door, the ear door, at the mind. At every sense door, there is peace. And so there's something very evocative about that description of just in every experience flowing in to the sense gates is met with peace. some teachers talk about enlightenment or some freedom as like happiness independent of conditions, the kind of happiness and well-being that is not contingent on the conditions of one's life. The Buddha spoke much more about what is shed than what is gained, meaning that there's much more description of what is released and surrendered rather than how freedom manifests. And typically it is the characterizes the cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah, that we these kind of wellsprings, these core wellsprings of suffering, this is abandoned. And when the forces of suffering are put down, we don't need to create happiness or joy or love. It's just there in the wake of that letting go. Some of the kind of notions of awakening are bound up with these teachings on self and not self. And Ajahn Sucitto said, characterized in this way, which kind of slightly different language, but I think quite helpful. So he said, the first level of liberation is to have a good self. May sound strange because we talk about not self, but what it really means is that the landscape of your chitta, the heart mind, is the landscape it sits on is pretty comfortable. It's fertile, it's green. You can move across it without getting blown up by something. There are no monsters lurking around, jumping on you. This itself is a profound benefit. And for one who goes further, one begins to dismantle the territory altogether. This is called the complete liberation. Chitta doesn't have territory, but that's another step. And then I remember he laughed after that, you know, that's another step. And he laughed, yeah. So it's hard because in a way, awakening is construed from the perspective of self. But awakening is not a possession or a kind of validation of the self. It's not an adornment of the personality. Trungpa Rinpoche used this famous phrase about like stepping out of the bureaucracy of ego. And in my own experience, this kind of all this language of this kind of specialness of spiritual attainment, of awakening, of these things, I don't know. I think the deeper we get, the more ordinary we actually feel. Generally, enlightenment has been defined as a kind of, as a discrete experience that emphasizes depth. So in a range of traditions, there is a kind of, they may emphasize different experience or different series of experiences, but it's usually something in the realm of kind of discrete unfolding that emphasizes depth, yeah, some kind of honoring of mystical experience. And that's beautiful, but I want to acknowledge like our spiritual freedom has two dimensions. It has depth and also breadth. So it has depth in terms of, yeah, you would, how deep we settle in and how deep the learnings are. But then there's also this dimension of breadth, meaning that how much of our life remains untouched by the Dharma, how much is blessed by the Dharma. And both are actually quite important. And in a certain way, depth has been celebrated, you know, for sure, more than breadth. But breadth is what actually makes us safe for each other, you know, what actually consolidates our sila, our ethical conduct. It's the dimension of breadth. And I've come to think of it, you know, more as the language of enlightenment implies a kind of yes, no, but the language of spiritual maturity implies more of a spectrum, that there's no one point where you say like, oh, you went from not enlightened to enlightened. There are some cardinal experiences I'll talk about a little that are meaningful in and of themselves, but and quite potent. But in general, I feel closer to the model where it's not a dichotomous yes no, but we fall, our chitta falls somewhere on a spectrum of spiritual maturity. And it's a spectrum that, as far as I can tell, has no end. That's different from the normal Theravadan view of like the completion of the arhat or something. But I don't think we can ever stop looking for delusion. So in my own practice and kind of grappling with some of this, you know, I've seen teachers like that undoubtedly had some kind of, yeah, significant kind of enlightenment experience. These are not, there are charlatans, there are people who are selling themselves, and actually don't really have insight, but there are for sure teachers that do. And some of them, you know, cause, you know, sort of like have all of that wisdom and still behave in ways that are harmful to others. They have like real dramatic lapses in sila, in ethical conduct. And there was something about that in seeing that a bit up close. No one I was really close to, but one Zen teacher I had some contact with, and just to see like, oh, this is somebody with incredible wisdom and who's done incredible harm. And there was something about that that shook me up in a deep way and prompted these questions of how can it be that like the harmfulness of their behavior cast this very serious shadow over the wisdom. And I grappled, you know, for quite a while, like how is it possible for the forces of awakening and harmfulness to coexist in one person? And what does it mean about the nature of enlightenment that it can coexist with really harmful behavior? And that broke something up inside of me, and it kind of sent me on my own kind of seeking to try to understand how that's so, and really to have a more nuanced vision of what spiritual maturity actually is. What does that mean? Does it mean just this single criteria of have you had this experience, you know? And so I have moved into a kind of more multifaceted kind of model of what spiritual maturity is. And so I'll share a few of the dimensions, and I'm just making this up. This is not, you know, from the suttas or something, but it's the kind of hallmarks of spiritual maturity that have seemed important. So there are experiences that transform subjectivity, that transform the nature of suffering as we practice. And this happens in a lot of ways. There's the side of practice that is about digesting pain, digesting the kilesas, digesting the forces of suffering. There's a dimension of practice that is about blessing the past, that the present is composed of memory and habit energies. And this path is very much about blessing all of that in the present moment, such that the charge of it is diffused. And there's a dimension of the path that is about just marinating in goodness and developing wholesomeness. And the cultivation of this kind of radically different subjectivity, it happens in many, many different ways. But one important element of it is something like non-ordinary states of awareness, of mystical experience. Mystical may not be the right word, but there's the Dharma celebrates mystical kind of experience. William James, the psychologist, philosopher, said mystical experience, he called it the root and center of religion. And any claims that, that freedom from suffering is possible is a mystical path, right? The Dharma celebrates a lot of non-ordinary states of awareness, of samadhi, concentration, jhana, emptiness, non-duality, cessation. All of this is pointing to a kind of the transformative potential of mystical experience. And I think that deserves like a pretty deep honoring. And at the same time, I don't want to reduce our spiritual maturation to that. And generally, I don't think of it as these kind of freestanding magical moments. I think of that, there's that, but it also depends on all the kind of work in the trenches that precedes moments like that. And the blessings of a transformative, liberating moment of insight in a certain way can't be untangled from all of the goodness that led up to it. The second aspect of maturity is a kind of exquisite sensitivity to harm. Krishnamurti said that said meditation is just to be sensitive, just to be sensitive. The mesh of one's own being becomes wider and wider. And as we start to see the poignancy of our own suffering, as we see that moment by moment, we are much more cautious about causing suffering to others. And so it's like the encounter with our own suffering has an ethical quality. If we open our heart to it, if we are actually softened rather than hardened by it, we can't help but be more careful with the hearts of others. And so we become more careful. We become more careful about harm. Non-harming is the kind of, this is the characteristic of the Dharma. This is the kind of key characteristic, non-harm, not harming oneself, not harming others. And we develop our heart, our love, and some of this comes in the direct path of just abiding in metta and love. And then some of it comes in the kind of the way love is generated by meeting suffering with equanimity, you know. And in my own practice, how many moments did I actually just, you know, sitting there, walking there, whatever, you know, in the rhythm of practice, just trying to let my heart be softened by the imperfection. This generates love too. This generates the kind of spirit of nonviolence and the kind of poignancy of suffering, of the First Noble Truth, of the suffering of all beings. This kind of dawns on us, breaks our heart open. And as we practice more and have a kind of, yeah, less coagulated form of self, it's sort of like you're just a more porous being. And it's not that there are no boundaries, but the sense of you just can feel the impacts of the world on your heart more, and it generates care. And so our self-absorption creates boundaries and divisions, and the metta, anatta, the teachings on love, on not self, this breaks down some of those boundaries and divisions. And when the self is not a preoccupation, what's left is the world. And then the third of four, and I'll wrap up in a few minutes, have a little time for discussion, is the third characteristic of spiritual maturity is humility. That the more you learn, the more humble you become. And that humility is not, that's fully compatible with a deep confidence, maybe we say unshakable, but it's, you can't be sincere in your practice and meet the kind of waves of dukkha, to meet the waves of our own compulsive energies, to meet the waves of our own participation in suffering. You can't do that honestly and not be humbled. And so there's an appreciation of our limitations, actually, a kind of certain respect for that. And that includes a kind of the limitations on assessing our own minds, that we can never, I don't feel, we can never stop looking for delusion, because it constellates in so many ways, you know, the kind of different layers of delusion, cultural kind of delusion. It's just there are too many ways for it to creep into our mind for us to say, I'm done looking. Because the truth is, we always think we're right until we realize we're wrong. Yeah. It's like delusion does not come with any kind of like warning flag on it, like black box warning, right? It's like, no, it just feels like the truth. And so we open to the permanent possibility of being wrong. And that seems to me like almost indispensable from how we grow and change. It's like a moral duty to acknowledge one's fallibility, the humility of acknowledging, oh yeah, don't know. And then the last characteristic that I just want to flag that I see often in kind of spiritual maturity is a kind of faith and an inspiration to keep going. One of my teachers, Shinzen Young, said the most mature criteria of like enlightenment or something like that. He said it was the most mature criteria is just to keep doing the practice. Yeah, that's how you assess your spiritual progress. You're just like there doing it. And for many of us, we've kind of like, well, we've fallen in love with a path, and it becomes almost like a companion. And we don't always know. It's not a faith that everything will work out fine or something like this, but it is, yeah, it's a faith of like, I must keep going. I must keep offering my heart to the moment. And there is a sense of like, oh yeah, when you're walking a path like that, when you're walking a path of care, of sensitivity, of love, it does cut through so much anxiety about how our life is going to turn out. And so these are some, I think, ways of actually understanding spiritual maturation, and offer it for your consideration. And so please pick up whatever is useful and leave the rest behind. We close. Any questions? And it could be about the talk or about practice or whatever. It's wide open. But you can just unmute yourself and jump in.